Thanks for listening to this message from the life of St. Bees. We're a church that loves to empower, equip and inspire. And in order to better fulfill this call, we're currently undertaking an audacious church relocation project. Find out more, including how you can take part, at www.goandgrow.london. Thank you, and may this message better help you to live a life full of adventurous faith.
So what we're going to be looking at today is the subject of spiritual resilience. And the reason why we thought this would be a good thing to talk about is because it's a really good thing to talk about and often doesn't get talked about very much. I was at New Wine this summer and went to a seminar by Dr. Ruth Perrin, who is my new favorite person. She was amazing. So I've basically nicked a whole load of stuff that she talked about to pass off as my own this evening, including the title. So I just love the title. We can have that on the slide maybe. It was, "Is Generation Snowflake's Faith Melting?" And the term Generation Snowflake is basically another term that's been given to millennials. And the millennial, for those of you who don't know, is generally defined as someone who's reached young adulthood this century. Okay, so millennial, someone who's become an emerging adult or young adult this century. However, the term snowflake, or the snowflake generation, it's not very positive. It's tend to either suggest a generation that are quite thin-skinned, that can't listen to any alternative viewpoint and have to have a safe space, also known as an echo chamber, that just keeps their own little thoughts together. Or it's been used as a term to, they just think they're all unique and they're too special, is another term. It's not very helpful, actually. And it's a huge oversimplification because, of course, every generation has got millions of people and they're all different. However, I think there is some truth to the fact that there are generational differences. These days you might hear people saying, 40 is the new 30. I remember hearing that and feeling there is hope. So how are millennials different from other generations? So let's remind ourselves, this generation, the baby boomers, they were the ones who all got born after the Second World War when finally men and women were back together again. There was peace, let's get breeding. And then you get your Generation X, and they were people who were born before the 1980s. And then we've got millennials, and some people are talking now about Generation Z and so on, which all sounds very zombie-like. But anyway, there are different generations, and in terms of thinking about spiritual resilience, there are some things that will affect some generations more than others. However, there are also just commonalities with all of us. At the end of the day, we're all human, and there are going to be things that all of us struggle with. So if we can just go to the next slide. Peter, I think, is a great example of someone who was not spiritually resilient. I was actually thinking about Peter as we sung some of the songs. I will build my life upon the rock. This is a firm foundation. And I will not be shaken. Often I feel like when I sing songs like that, I can almost hear the cock crowing in the background. Because I'm not really like that, actually. Often I'm not giving my whole heart. Often I'm not doing all these wonderful things that I'm singing. Let me give you an example. This is John chapter 13. Jesus, for context, is talking with his disciples just after having had the last meal he's going to have with them that we've just been remembering today. "A new command I give you, love one another. Just as I've loved you, so you must love one another. And by this, everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." Simon Peter asked him, "But Lord, where are you going?" Jesus replied, "Where I'm going, you cannot follow now, but you will follow later." Peter asked, "Lord, why can't I follow you now? I will lay down my life for you." Then Jesus answered, "Will you? Will you really lay down your life for me? Because I'm telling you, before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times." So that's Peter. He's not the only person who sung the songs, who's overpromised and who spectacularly failed. Most of us have had our moments. We've had those moments where we've failed morally or spiritually, ethically. Another of the main followers of Jesus, considered one of like the top 12, was Thomas, and he experienced serious doubt. Is that okay? Why didn't Jesus have better discernment? Why didn't he choose better people? Well, because he chose ordinary people, and ordinary people like you and me, we fail. However, unlike both Peter and Thomas, most of us are not going to go on to found the church or be crucified upside down. So it's interesting, when Peter asked, Lord, why can't I follow you now? Jesus had said, where I'm going, you cannot follow me now, but you will follow later. And that's considered to be actually Jesus prophesying and letting Peter know, like, trust me, one day it's going to get hard. One day you are going to follow where I'm going, but not yet. Right now you're not ready. So if we look at the next, yeah, here we go. So most of us are not going to found the church, and like Peter did, and most of us, like Thomas, are not going to end up being stoned in India. And by stoned in India, I mean stoned to death, not on drug stoned, which is fairly easy to do in India. So both had moments of doubt and failure, but both of them ended well. If we can say that martyrdom is a good end, which I think in a weird kind of way it really is. So how can we end well? How can this generation of young adults develop the kind of faith that Peter and Thomas, who both had their issues, managed to develop? And how can we finish well as well? So first off, in some ways, it's never been easier. Since the end of the Second World War, nominal Christianity has massively declined. It used to be that everyone in England went to church because that's what you did to be a Christian. And often those churches were incredibly religious and boring and dull. And the good news is that today, most of the nominalism has kind of burnt off. And these days, people who come to church, it's because they really want to meet with God. And a lot of churches, not all by any means, but a lot of churches in the UK are doing well because of that same reason, because the Holy Spirit is there, because stuff is happening. Even if I think about my childhood, like when I was a kid, finding a church where the Holy Spirit was at work was really difficult, actually. It's much easier now. However, there are some things that are very different for millennials. For a start, traditionally 21 is the age where people become an adult. Yeah, I think we all agree on that. And adulthood is that point where you become fixed in a sense of who you are, what your values are, and how you see the world. It's not the development stage that happens before that, as you're gradually figuring these things out. Yeah, what do I believe? Yeah, who am I? How do I tick? That's a definition I'm using here for emotional adulthood. And actually, if we go back 50 years, when you hit 21, that was pretty much the time where adulthood would happen. People would finish their apprenticeship or university for some, and then they would go on and they would usually get married, they'd have a full-time job, get a mortgage. Back then, you could buy a house. Who knew? Even in London. So that was when people started to become more staid, whereas today, they say that things have shifted a lot, and actually, this period of emerging adulthood for today's generation goes up to about the age of 30. So whereas 50 years ago, people were adult at 21, now it's about 30. Now, that's both a really positive thing, in that it means that we have the opportunity to reach young adults. It used to be kind of universities when you try and share Jesus with people, and if they haven't accepted him by then, it's kind of game over. You might have a little flicker of hope when they have their first kid and think, wait a minute, what kind of world have I brought this kid into? But apart from that, it was kind of they were pretty much done. Whereas actually, today's generation are much more open to figuring things out and open to other ideas. What it can also mean is that people who have been strong Christians during their early adulthood, so in their early 20s, by their late 20s, never mind by their late 30s, maybe saying, actually, I don't think I'm a Christian anymore. Or love Jesus, but hate church. And we'll come on to that soon. Statistically, half of the kids who are growing up in religious homes, and this seems to be across the board, whether whatever religion, Christian, Muslim, whatever, but roughly half of those kids will adopt their parents' faith. In other words, roughly half those kids won't. So if you've come from a Christian family, you've got a 50% chance of, statistically, of following on from that. Another of the challenges we have today is that faith is considered something that you opt into. It used to be something that you opted out of, but now secularism is the norm. It's normal to be secular. It's not normal to be religious. Then we've got social media, which just gives us a plethora of choice and can make it really hard sometimes to figure out, actually, what do I believe? What do other people believe? So Ruth Perrin, this woman I mentioned before, she's done a lot of research into young adults who were on fire for Jesus when they were young adults, and then looking at them 20 years later to see how they fared. She found that some of them had kept their faith and were going strong. She found that there was a second category of people who would say, "No, I'm a Christian and I love Jesus, but like, not church." So people who really kind of loved Jesus hated church, and then a third category of people who would say, "I am no longer a Christian. I was once, like, I was involved in my Christian union at university, or I did this, or I did that. I was really on fire, and now I'm not." Why do people lose their faith? Why do people keep their faith? How do you build spiritual resilience? These are some of the things I'm hoping we can look at. So I'm going to hand over to Luke, and he's going to help split us up. I'm going to get you to do some thinking about this and some discussing, and then we're going to bring it back.
Okay. So you guys, number one, you're going to be focusing on the first group of people Chris spoke about. So the people who were on fire for Jesus back in the uni days, and now they've completely lost their faith. Middle section group two, you're going to be the second group of people. So people who were really on fire for God, they would still say they have a faith in Jesus Christ, but church is not for them. They've fallen out of love with church. And you guys, number three, you are the guys who were on fire for Jesus and who are still on fire for Jesus, still attending a church, still very much involved. Now, what you're going to be discussing is the very simple question of why? What leads people into these categories? Firstly, and secondly, what's your experience of this kind of person? Do you have any personal stories, personal experience? Maybe this is you that we're talking about. What are the main factors and influences around that? So you've got 5 or so minutes to discuss that. Make sure everyone gets something to say. You can do it. Ready? Go. So we're going to start with group number one, which is over here, just testing. So I'm going to try and rove, but it might sound like the apocalypse, so just do bear with me. I'll swap mics, apparently this is the bad one. It's not going to sound like the apocalypse. Here we go. Okay, group one, have we got any reasons? We'll start with this group, your best reason.
So I think it depends a lot on your frame of reference for Christianity and God when you're a child. So if you place your faith more in the people of church, these fallible, sinful, hypocritical people, then that's going to kind of cause you to fall away.
Yeah, that's so good. I think we can, people are so damaged by people, aren't they? So that's a really good thing to think about. You guys, why would someone lose their faith? Who's going to be
Yeah, I think we said, like, it can be various things, so circumstances, whether that is, like, in church of, it's in church, it's circumstances, like, negative stuff, possibly, or it's, like, life stuff as well, so it's, like, hitting hard times, and, yeah, kind of, like, just that causing the question of why, and I think that was discussed, like, personal as well, so, Yeah, I think we also say examples how we like knew various people, whether it was like family, friends, or friends who yeah, we kind of like, yeah, had faith and believed and, yeah, fell away because of those reasons. Yeah.
Great. Yeah, I think we all know someone who's had a real tragedy that's just taken them away from faith, and it's really hard to talk to them about it, and they kind of feel guilty for having a faith, I find. Anyone in this group got any gems?
We've got quite a few here, but just the best one, getting out of the habit. Getting out of the habit of actually going to church, getting out of the habit of being a Christian, and linking to that a sort of lack of practicing faith, lack of fellowship.
Yeah, I think that's so good. I think something Chris is going to talk about is how it's a slow process. You rarely lose your faith overnight, and it can start with things like habits. You guys, anyone want to share? Go on, I dare you. Yes.
So I was saying that if I look at my own friends and stuff that used to go to church and probably perhaps no longer do, I think if I'm really blunt, half of them perhaps didn't have much of a faith to begin with. So they would come to church because either their parents brought them along or our friends were here. So you just come to church because of that. And therefore, once they're left to their own, they just choose not to go to church because their faith was lacking to begin with. And the second is distractions, I guess. Like, as you get older, especially you go to uni, then there's lots of things to be distracted on a Sunday evening. And then you just kind of get out of the habit, as they were saying. And then your faith will kind of just drift away a little.
Yeah, it's a good question about, we said that people rarely opt in, but at a young age, there is an element of opt-in, especially with Christian parents. I'm standing very close to you, sorry. Anyone on this group? Yes. Okay, sorry about this.
Ooh. I think we came up with the solution that we are living in a post-Christian era. I mean, 50 years ago or 100 years ago, the whole country was Christian, and this was enshrined in law. Now, if your environment is really anti-Christian, it's very difficult to hold on to your Christian values.
So just to speak into that for a moment, what you're describing is kind of Christendom. And Christendom is a term that we use to describe sort of societal or institutional Christianity. You know, if you go back beyond 50 years, go back 200 years or whatever, 300 years, the church was the main area of control and power in many parts of Europe. And in many ways, the death of Christendom, certainly for me, gets a big hurrah and a RIP, because often that was this kind of dead religion. However, what we've lost with that is a normality when it comes to Christian belief. And even in the last 30 years or so, there's the beginning of a divergence between what most people think is good and right. So if you, 20, 30 years ago, most people would agree, broadly speaking, yeah, it's probably good if you're married that you don't, you know, cheat on your partner. It's probably good if you don't do this, if you don't do that. And most of societal morality was more or less the same as biblical morality, but that's starting to shift now, particularly in the area of sexuality and gender. And so it's a challenging new world for people in this post-Christendom society. But with it, what it means is that the church is becoming much more of a Gideon's army. So it's smaller than it has been in the past, but it's definitely stronger as well.
I think you'll find that if you research, most research studies show that 50-60% of people in this country believe in prayer and the power of prayer, and pray regularly once a week or more. And yet, well under 10% go to church.
Yeah.
And I can't help feeling that the fault is with most churches. We're not part of this, of some bees, but I believe that St. Bees is one of the few exceptions, which are so marvelous. And the problem which I had is boredom and lack of connection between the church and the individual, lack of pastoral care, which are so marvelous in this church. And in places like Holy Trinity Brompton, for example, where we go quite regularly. And so there is such an opportunity, tremendous opportunity, for more and more churches like this. And HDB are at the moment aiming to have 100 plant churches all over the country.
Thank you. Yeah. I think we can do a lot better, but thank you for being kind about us.
We're working on it. It leads us nicely into group two.
Before we go to group two, let's go through some of the other things that... is anyone else from group one?
No.
Okay. So some of the things that Ruth found was you've got your kind of mayor people who came along and went to church often because they had to, or parents brought them, or they fancied someone or whatever. And then once they were free to go off and do what they liked, they went off and did what they liked. She talks a little bit about the locked box faith. So what many people do is they go off to university or their first time away from home, and they're like, I'm here to have fun, and my faith is going to fit in a box under my bed, and who knows what I'm going to do on top of that bed, but hey, I'm here at university, let's go. And that's what they do. But then about a year later, sometimes 2 years later, they end up going to something like New Wine or a church or some kind of gathering, and they realize, actually, like, I want to reconnect with God, and like, I've had fun, and it's not all it was cracked up to be, like just living the way that I want to live, doing all the things I was always told I wasn't meant to do. The kind of novelty's worn off that a little bit, and they come back to faith. So that's one thing. But so we're looking at, so there are people who have just drifted along and then drifted away. But what about the people who have really been passionate followers of Jesus? And I do not buy the whole, they weren't really a Christian in the first place. I'm talking about people who love Jesus and they've walked away. Here are a few things that Ruth says. She said that she only interviewed a small sample. There were only about 6 or 7 of them. She said all of them were really distressed during the interview. 6 out of the 7 of them wept uncontrollably. They said it was isolating, it was lonely, and it was really frightening. And it didn't just happen with a shrug of the shoulders, it was heartbreaking. It was a really serious issue. For many of them, what she found was that they'd not been given permission to wrestle with their faith, to ask questions, to say, actually, I don't know about this. Resurrection? Oh, sounds a bit like a fairy tale, or whatever it is. They weren't given any permission. They was just, come on, get your praise face on. Gotta love Jesus. And given a little bit of a pep talk, but there was no room for doubt. There was no room for asking the hard questions. In other words, they had been given no preparation in a safer environment to work through stuff, and when they did start to ask questions, people were scared of it. Like, oh, keep your doubt to yourself; it might be contagious. Like, don't tell the others. And so, what would happen is as people would feel isolated, they wouldn't have anyone to talk to, and they certainly weren't talking to God, because often that's the problem with doubt. It does create a barrier between you and God. They talked about having a lack of faith community. And often that was their fault. So particularly university graduates, they never really got involved in a church because they wanted to meet up with their uni friends every weekend. And so they were never really around on a Sunday for long enough to kind of get bedded into a Christian community in the new place where they had their job. And actually, UK society is a very, very difficult culture to break into. We're not actually very good at making friends as a culture on the whole. So they found it really hard. So lack of community, lack of having Christians who are asking them hard questions, like, how are you doing? I just recently talked to someone who's been so on fire for their faith here at St. Bees. And who, over the last 6 months or so, has drifted a bit. And I just said to her, like, is it just me or is this happening? And she was like, yeah, it's happening. And actually, I'm really glad that you said something, because like, I'm starting to drift. I don't want to do this. Like, how do I get back? So we started talking about that, which is really good. One of the big issues was that many people's faith had never been prepared for suffering and had never been prepared for personal crisis. Another fantastic seminar I went to at New Wine the year before talked about the most common and most quoted meme on social media from the Bible, the most common Bible verse. It's not, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only son." It's, "For I know the plans I have for you, says the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you and to give you a future." And like, the woman talking about it, it's like, have any of them actually read the context of this? This is like saying, you're going to exile, you're going to die in exile. Your kids are going to be born into exile. They're going to die in exile. Your grandchildren, they're going to get to come back. "For I know the plans I have for you, says the Lord." Let's read things in context so that when crap hits the fan, which it will do, we're ready for it. And she talked about, like, "I cannot tell you how many people I know who are like, well, I used to believe in God, but then my goldfish died. And that, I didn't get the guy. I didn't get the job promotion. We found out that we can't have kids. This happened, that happened, this person died, that person died." I mean, this summer I found out, just on the back of two fantastic weddings, one of them was my sister's, found out that one of my best friends and his wife and his four-year-old son were murdered. That was awful. She was raped brutally and then murdered. What do we do with that? Is that the kind of thing that will send us away from God, or is it the kind of thing that will send us to God? So what she found, Dr. Ruth, was that often when a personal crisis leads to an existential crisis of like, actually, is God good? I think I've certainly had experiences where I've said, "God, I know that you're there. I just don't know if you're good." And let me tell you, God can handle it, and he knows it anyway. So why would I not say it? He knows what I'm thinking. Do you know what I mean? So getting to a point where people don't have a good community around them who can support them, where they've never really questioned things before, and where suddenly things start happening, disappointment, mental health, depression, whatever it might be, that then lead to them saying, "Okay, I'm done. I am done. I'm walking away." But the people who walked away, it was with absolute grief and heartbreak. And that makes me so sad and makes me wonder how many people have walked away from our church and maybe we didn't even realize. I mean, thank you for what you said, but we aren't great on pastoral care. It's something we're working on. We want to get better. But it is easy to fall through the cracks. So how do we build a faith like that? But anyway, let's look at the next group of people.
Okay, so group two, we're going to whiz through these. People who still love Jesus, but who do not like the church, don't like the institution of the church, reasons why they might have left, where they're at. Pete Grant.
So our group was talking about having a personal faith in Jesus, and that being the most important thing. And we kind of said, well, you can worship at home, you can pray at home. What is it about church that kind of keeps you coming here? And we reflected on stories of friends. The two kind of main reasons was because they were LGBT+, they were gay, or because they had a relationship with a non-Christian, and someone at church had said something to them that made them feel unwelcome, that made them feel like it was a place of judgment. And we said, you know, when you're coming to a place every week and there's judgment around who you are, it makes you feel like, whereas church should be kind of a little booster of your faith every week, it can be detrimental to your faith just to walk in and feel like you're part of a community that's judgmental. So we said, kind of, there's an onus on the church, not this church specifically at all, but there's an onus on the church to become a place of welcome.
So good. I can definitely resonate with that as well. Any other than group two got a burning point to raise?
Yes.
Let's have one. Yes, Beth.
I think Generation Y, millennials, whatever you want to call them, are quite transient. So I was saying that this is my fourth church in 3 years just because of house moves and job moves. And I think it's really quite difficult for young people to get settled into churches, especially if young people aren't going to churches. It's one of the good things about this church is that there's a good group, but the one before this one didn't have many young people, and it was really, really difficult to get stuck into that.
I wonder as well, if you've come from a family where you've been going to church and you've been in the same church all your life, actually the task of finding a church that is the right expression for you, how easy that might be, and going around and sort of thinking, actually, it doesn't match up to where I've been before, it doesn't have this, it doesn't have that, rather than actually maybe what it does have and how you then can build relationships within that. We were saying that they don't used to have kind of student meals and Sundays and things, and when I was a student, and families would connect with the students or young people, and there was that point of connection, and it doesn't seem to be quite as popular now.
That's great, yeah. Finding individuality in your faith as well is crucial. Got one more. Yes, Emma.
I was just going to say that a lot of people say go to CU or church or something at uni, and then when they move somewhere new, they have to find it for themselves. And at uni, it's very much, come to CU, here or the church, you can come here or here or here, and it's kind of thrown in your face. Whereas when you are the one person moving to a new area, the onus is on you to find it. And if you don't know that you need to, or you don't have that experience that actually church is a really good thing, then it's hard, particularly if all your other friends are going out Saturday night and you don't want to have to be the only one getting up at 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning. Like, why would you bother unless you know that it's a really good thing?
It's good. I think that comes with the extension of that development adult period, that we don't see the need for 21, 22, 23-year-olds to give them those options.
Oh, there's one more there.
For group two? Okay, quick,
we've got group three are sneaking in here.
Unbelievable.
Just because it's something that hasn't been mentioned yet. I had a difficult experience where I was part of a church that started off really great and then became spiritually abusive. And thankfully, I had really good people around me who took me to another church's small group and things like that and kept me going sort of through that. But I'm now at a really good, solid church. And I found it really tough to connect. And I joined the new church at a time when they were saying, oh, we're going to change up the evening service and how are we going to do it and this kind of thing. And I'm like, I just want this to be a safe place. And even as a really well-established Christian who kept hold of my faith, it was really very hard for me to continue. So if you were less secure in your faith, how much would that shake you?
Great. Thank you for that. So a few of the things that Dr. Ruth had found from her findings. One, that I think we've talked about already, is just the patterns of a lot of people when they leave university end up in a new place where they don't really know anyone. And every weekend, they just want to meet up with their friends who are now scattered all over the country. And so they don't really make time or make a priority for trying to get settled into a church. And churches still today tend to be quite Sunday-centric, although that is changing. So that can be an issue, trying to find a church family. And often they're like, well, it's something I'll do at some point, and then it never quite happens, and you kind of get used to it not happening. A bit like I don't know if you've gone without a meal or two, like you feel really hungry, but actually if you fast by day two, you're kind of not that, your stomach's shrunk, you just got used to something different. Kind of following on from what you said about bad examples of church was a big one, particularly bad examples of leadership. I think of a friend of mine, she was very involved in a vibrant church with a really amazing young adults ministry. She was working closely with this young married pastor, and he just got a bit too friendly with her. And then he made advances on her, and she went to the elders in the church and said, look, this guy tried it on with me. I don't think that's right. And so the elders met, and then they asked her to leave. They said, we need to protect his reputation. So we'd like you to go. And she did. And she is not going to church anymore. So that's really sad. Sometimes it's seeing church leaders just behaving horribly towards one another. So seeing mass examples of conflict and just nastiness amongst people who have been raised up as leaders. Theological tensions can be another one. Sometimes it's oversimplification of things or triumphalism. Yeah, we're going to kick ass for Jesus. And they're like, really? Can we just get beyond that? Being involved in a ministry that got shut down due to over-controlling leaders was a big one, where like something was going really well and then some leader felt they had to kind of like just come in and control it. And so they're like, well, I'm done with church then. A big one was lack of leadership opportunities. So looking for opportunities to get involved more heavily and having people investing in them. For many people, it's a frustration with a resistance to innovation or change. Well, that's not how we've always done it. And they're like, no, that's why your church is dying. And then a huge one was lack of welcome and a lack of authentic Christian community. This generation do not want Sunday best. They're not interested in turning up and pretending everything's great. They're looking for something that feels real, warts and all. And we need to be that community. And if we're not, then something's wrong with us. Last group.
Yeah. We're still on, yes. Group three. So this is people who have kept their faith and still have a faith.
I was very interested because I could have been originally in any of the three groups. I came to Christianity from a different religion. I did consider giving it up because of ostracization. And I did get quite hurt in various churches. But I think one of the things that really kept me, even though I've struggled with Chris, is that you can't be all good God if you're all powerful sort of thing, is there's a supernatural element. And I've actually had really very powerful experiences of God, especially when I've been really down and really thinking I can't take anymore. And I feel that feeling of having God having his hand on my life, even when it doesn't feel like, is what's kept me going to church.
Yeah, I can definitely resonate with that as well. Group three, any more around the corner? Yes, Ross.
We said it was family and networks and friends that had sort of kept us going and had encouraged those disciplines. And sometimes you do need discipline, because if I came to church only when I felt like it, I probably wouldn't come very frequently. So there has to be some element of discipline. And we said there was something about, yeah, what you whether you've encountered God, as well, so whether you just know it in your head, or whether actually you've had personal experience and the level of personal experience.
So good. Cara?
I think one key thing for me is just seeing how God works through other people's lives, or other friends' lives, and just witnessing that, and just like, wow, like I've seen you from there and to now, like, yeah, that can only be God that's taking you through this. So that's been really encouraging.
Just to add to that, I was talking about this with someone the other day. For me, watching people when I've lived in other countries that are so different from here and seeing people change. Like, I remember a friend of mine in Uzbekistan, he said, since I've been reading this green book, talking about the New Testament, he said, like, I don't know, like, before, whenever my wife would go off to visit her mum for the weekend, I'd just go and have sex with this woman who lives, you know, just in the factory and it's around there. And now, I don't know why, but since I've been reading this book, I just feel that I shouldn't be doing that anymore. and he, you know, came from a background where that was, she doesn't know, no problem. And that was the Holy Spirit at work. And seeing the same consistency of lives changing, whatever the cultural context.
Should we come into land?
Yeah, so I'm aware we're going over time a bit. We knew we were today. So here are a few things that Ruth also added. She mainly talked about outward things, and I'm going to finish with some inward things as well. So she said, often these were people who'd experienced early struggles and wrestles with faith issues, but in an environment where they're allowed to. So where they had people they could talk to and say, like, I don't really get this, or I don't get that, or why do you think this? Often they were people who had moved somewhat in the theology or churchmanship that they had inherited. So sometimes people who'd grown up in a more conservative church discovering, wow, the Holy Spirit, isn't this great? But actually, sometimes people coming from really sort of happy-clappy, discovering some of the really great things about a more contemplative and quieter spirituality and worship. They usually had a really strong faith community of people who had their backs and were looking out for them and looking after them. Really importantly, they had been mentored And we'll come on to that in a minute. They saw their everyday lives and jobs as ministry. They felt called to be Jesus wherever it was that they were going. They lived out their faith Monday to Saturday, not just Sundays. They found communities where they felt real and authentic, and where they could be real and authentic. They found communities where they could participate. People who kept their faith were not just passengers. They were involved in what was going on in their churches and in their church ministries. And they had others who'd listen to them and support them. Not always church leaders, particularly when it came to doubt and to questions. So how can we finish well? Here are just a few really simple tips. Next slide, yeah, brilliant, thanks. First of all,
so
I think...
Just to say, as Chris goes through these, I need you to lock into the one thing that you think, yes, I need to apply this to my life, because this will be your walk the talk. So do focus.
That's woken you up. So the first thing is, it is up to you. It's up to me. We're ultimately responsible for our own lives and our own spirituality and for building spiritual resilience. No one else can actually do this for us. This is something that we need to take responsibility for. And one of the challenges for emerging adults is learning to take responsibility. So it's like, it's up to me. So it starts with you. How much time do you devote to God? Like any other relationship, it needs time. I met up with one of my best friends recently, and we just see each other like once every couple of years. We live in different countries, and it's great when we meet up, but it also feels a little bit like, well, we're friends because we've always been friends. And actually, like, it's a good friendship, but it's not as good as it could be because we're not spending enough time with each other. All friendships are like that. They need time. What rhythms do you have in your week for this? When are you spending regular time with God? In prayer, listening to him, reading his word. Do we have a theology that has room for disappointment and broken dreams and challenges and injustices? Where are you on the entitlement scale? I think that this generation feels more entitlement than any generation beforehand. Like, we just think things should be good. Like, I should get to have a good job. I should be happy. I should be thin. I should be with the man or woman of my dreams. I should be able to have kids if I want them, or not if I don't want them. I should be able to have this. Because look, everyone else does. Just look at Instagram. You know, that's the kind of world that we live in. How entitled are you? Maybe it's time to do a bit of soul searching. What kind of Christian community do you have around you? Who's got your back? Who challenges you and who loves you and who chases after you and who listens to you and learns from you? Do you have a prayer partner or a prayer triplet, or, you know, are you part of a 2-4 group? Have you been mentored? Interestingly, millennials are more open to friendship with older people than any other past generation has been. Like, when I was 20, there's no way I wanted to hang out with someone who was 40. Well, apparently, millennials are different. In fact, according to research, the optimum age of people who are most respected and looked up to as role models and potential mentors for millennials is 47. Who knew? Don't ask me why. I have no idea why. So are you being mentored? One of the things I've loved about having a mentor myself is having someone who will really give me, like, rollicking, can I use that word? Yeah, I think I can. And will challenge me, will ask me hard things. Will say, actually, Chris, like, You are not doing all right in this area. What are you going to do about it? And we live in an age where we're so desperate to sort of be nice to each other and actually to have someone who you've given permission to and who loves you. They're not just some random judger. That this is someone who you're welcoming into your life to actually call you out on stuff. It's really helpful. And also to love you. And also to show you, to have your back, someone who's looking out for you. So that's the mentoring.
Just to jump in on that.
Please do.
The key thing that Ruth Perrin identified is the question that millennials ask to those, that age group of 47 around there, is how did you get through this? I'm having this struggle. You must have had it. How are you still a Christian? Because I know that you've gone through this as well.
Yeah. And what they don't want is just Obi-Wan Kenobi wisdom. what they're looking for is actual friendship and someone to do life with them. So we may have some potential mentors in this room. We may have some potential mentees. I would actually say we're all called to be both. Paul says really clearly, what I have received, I now pass on. What I have received, I now pass on. So really, all of us should be learning from other people further along and helping those who are less further. Just got a few other quick ones. Are there areas of theology where you feel disconnected or possibly even bitter? Areas where you think, wait a minute. So like Peter mentioned, the whole LGBT plus. That's a really interesting issue to look at. Is that something that you need to, don't just bury your head in the sand. Figure out, okay, seriously, what does Jesus say about this? What should be my attitude? Sometimes it is people not knowing what to do with bitterness, feeling angry or bitter towards the church, having felt wronged and feeling unable to get beyond unforgiveness and just nursing that grudge. If you've ever had a grudge, the term nursing is exactly the right term. We just look after it and we carefully tend it. Where can there be space in your faith to let go of that? Have you ever given yourself permission to explore hard questions and to wrestle with stuff that you don't understand or stuff that you don't like in the Bible? I tell you, there's some stuff in the Bible I'm like, what? And I've had the privilege of being in a theological institute where I've been able to wrestle with some of those things. You know, where I've been able to say to a tutor, this book here, like, I had to restrain myself from throwing it across the room because I was so angry with what was written in it. Are you a passenger or are you a participant in this community? Do you talk about the church or is it like our church? Do you have ownership? And if you don't have ownership, I'll tell you how you can get it. Participate. That's what leads to ownership. Really, it's just rocking up on a Sunday is not ownership.
Parking.
Is ownership. So those are a few things you could be thinking about that can help you strengthen your faith. And faith, like a muscle, if you don't use it, it gets weak, you know? So let's continue this conversation in the pub afterwards now as well. Like, how can we build faith? But also, how can you be involved, particularly, I think, in mentoring? Because that's something that we're really wanting to grow in the church. Do you want to say more about that?
Yeah, so mentoring, we really want to push that and facilitate that. So if you're keen to be a mentee or a mentor, then do speak to myself. I'll be writing names down. And we just want to provide a space where we can partner you up with someone and really help you along with that. And we do have mentor training coming up in October as well. So if you're keen for that, do speak to me and we'll give you some more details.